Support for this program comes from Jazz on the Tube, the Internet's largest collection of free streamable classic jazz videos. From Miles Davis to Louis Armstrong, from Thelonious Monk to Duke Ellington, you'll find it all on jazzonthetube.com. Start your free subscription today.
Hi, and welcome to Jazz Talk, a Jazz on the Tube podcast. My name is Ken McCarthy, and this is where we talk with people who are doing important work that supports and illuminates the music we love. The writers, the scholars, the educators, the filmmakers, the producers, and more. And I want to set the stage for this upcoming interview. We're going to be talking with Dave Oliphant, author of numerous books that we're going to be describing. And Dave was born in 1939 in Fort Worth. The book we're going to be spending most of our time talking about, Tex and Jazz, was published 23 years ago, and I just discovered it this month, and what a thrill it is. You know, if you look at a famous book of biography, jazz biographies, let's take Leonard Feather's and Ira Gittler's The Biographical Encyclopedia Jazz, and just flip through it, you won't find a single page that doesn't have at least one Texas jazz man on it. They're everywhere. It's kind of like the elephant in the living room. There, and nobody really notices it. And if you think about it, you know, we've got Scott Joplin, born in Texarkana, Texas, the founder of ragtime, all the way through to Ornette Coleman, born in Fort Worth, Texas, the founder of free jazz. And then you have Charlie Christian, born in Texas, the creator of the modern jazz guitar. Then you have Jack Teagarden, born in Texas, the inventor of the modern jazz trombone. And then you even have people like Gene Ramey, who mentored young 15-year-old Charlie Parker and was his practice partner for years. And on it goes. In fact, let me just do a quick rundown. This isn't everybody, right? I'm just hitting a few names. Scott Joplin, we mentioned Hersel Thomas, Teddy Wilson, Red Garland, Cedar Walton, Horace Tapscott, Joe Sample, Charles Moffett, Ronald Shannon Jackson, Eddie Durham, Charlie Christian, Herb Ellis, Larry Coryell, Buster Smith, Bud Johnson, Prince Lachey, John Carter, Leo Wright, James Clay, Hubert Laws, Julius Hemphill, Eddie Cleanhead Vincent, King Curtis, David Fathead Newman, Arnett Cobb, Buddy Tate, see who else, Lamar Wright, Hot Lips Page, Kenny Durham, Marvin Hannibal Peterson, Roy Hargrove. Let's see, I mean, that's a pretty good list right there. So that's what we're going to be talking about in this call, the extraordinary contribution of Texan musicians to jazz, not only as sidemen, but, and they did, they were sidemen in every band, Blue Devils, Benny Moten, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, Cab Calloway, Charlie Parker. Wherever you look, there's a Texan on the bandstand. But not only were they sidemen, they were also big innovators. To set the tone and to give you a sense of where Dave is coming from, I asked him to read an excerpt from the preface of Texan Jazz.
Even before encountering the indispensable writings of jazz scholars, it was fundamental to my appreciation of this music that a Beaumont orchestra teacher, Harold Meehan, found in 1954 a place for me as third chair trumpet in the South Park High School dance band. It was this inspirational teacher from St. Louis who awakened me to musicians like Dizzy Gillespie and Charlie Parker, whose live performances Mr. Meehan had heard in his hometown, and whose recordings he played for us during lunchtime, or before, or at the end of the school day. Only after such music had fired my imagination and prompted me to seek out recordings by earlier jazz men did my own father reveal his awareness of and fondness for the music of Duke Ellington, Jimmy Lunsford, Cab Calloway, and Charlie Christian. Following my father's death, my mother recalled to me that when they were first married, my dad had made 500 addressograph cards at a penny apiece to earn $5 so they could hear the Ellington Orchestra when it came to Fort Worth in the 1930s. She remembered how they would stand behind the Duke and watch him at the piano. And when Dad would speak to me of Ellington, it was clear that this jazz man was something of a hero, that the Duke, in fact, was his all-time favorite music maker. It always impressed me that, as a man born in the one-horse railroad town of Bayard, with only an eighth-grade education and with no real talent for music except as a dancer, he recognized, understood, and deeply appreciated Ellington's artistic achievement. Dad would attempt to describe to me, from having watched the Duke and his men, how the pianist, the bassist, and Sonny Greer on drums would all hit together on the offbeat to build up for the rest of the group a marvelous type of revolving, swinging rhythm. For Dad, Lunsford, too, was extraordinary, and he loved to reminisce about dancing with Mother to Jimmy's orchestra during those Depression years before World War II. Cab's hidey-ho songs he never tired of hearing, and Charlie Christian's Blues and B he had me play over and over.
And today we're going to be talking with Dave Oliphant. And Dave's done some fantastic scholarship and poetry, and a lot of it focuses on jazz out of Texas. Now, the typical storyline for jazz is it started in New Orleans, and then it was fueled by Kansas City and Chicago and New York City. And all that's true, and all that's important. But one of the missing parts of the story, I think it's so important, is to know that jazz came from everywhere. You know, these big cities like Chicago and New York and Kansas City, they drew the talent because that's where the work was. But the musicians and the artists came from all over the country. And one of the great sources of jazz talent throughout the entire history of the music has been the great state of Texas. And if you think about it even a little bit, just some of the artists that you know, Ornette Coleman, for example, Dewey Redman, and it goes on and on. And Dave Oliphant has written two books on this subject, Texan Jazz, and then a follow-up book called Jazz Mavericks of the Lone Star State. He's also written a beautiful poem novel dedicated to Kenny Durham, another great Texan jazz man. And we're going to talk about all these things and see if we can all fit it all into our call. So welcome, Dave, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
So, Dave, you're a Texas native?
Yes, Fort Worth.
And Fort Worth. And I've spent time, I grew up in New York City, but I spent a lot of time in the San Francisco Bay Area. And one of the things I noticed was there were a whole lot of people from Texas originally
right. Who
ended up in the Bay Area. A lot of people that contributed a lot to the great jazz scene in Texas. And of course, my old friend Ornette Coleman, was very aware that he was from Texas. And then of course the great jazz education institution up in Texas there, North Texas State
at the time. Now it's University of North Texas.
University of North Texas. I mean, that's been a powerhouse for jazz education forever.
Right.
So Dave, you write beautifully about how, we'll just start there, how, you know, you sort of, like all of us, you got a taste of jazz, you encountered it as a young person, and you liked it, and you got a little more and a little more. And at a certain point, you discovered that there's no end to it. There's endless, bottomless riches in this music. You could just, you could live 100 lifetimes and you wouldn't even scratch the surface of
right. All
the things that have been developed.
Yeah, it's just endless.
And so tell us, since you are the expert on this, you're the guy that's written the books, What are the rest of us missing? You know, what do we not realize about Texas and its role, not only in being the birthplace of many great musicians, but being a cultural center that actually contributed to the music as a whole?
Well, it's just amazing the different places, even within Texas, where jazz musicians came from. And it amazes me how they discovered jazz. For instance, there was a trumpet player who played with Woody Herman, and he said at some point that his family didn't have a radio growing up. So he had never heard big bands or anything, and then later ended up starring in one. So it's curious how people came to jazz, but there was a terrific band in the Panhandle that traveled up to Colorado and just blew people's minds away. And how these people discovered jazz is still, to me, is something of a mystery, because they came from all different kinds of places where there were not necessarily jazz groups. For instance, Jack Teagarden in the north of Texas, near the Oklahoma borderline, he didn't know what jazz was called. I mean, he didn't know the music that he was playing or that he was hearing. He didn't know it was jazz. So to me, it's very curious that people came to the music in many different ways from many different places. And as you said in your leadoff, jazz musicians just came from everywhere.
I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, a place like New Orleans, well, that had all kinds of clubs and venues and, you know, New York City, of course, Chicago, Kansas City. I mean, they were famous for having just dozens and dozens of clubs and places where musicians could play. So the music was really in the air, and it was exactly part and parcel of everyday life. But, you know, I've driven through Texas from east to west, from one end of the state to the other, and, you know, it's big and it's rural.
Yeah,
you know, there are some big,
yeah,
I mean, there are some big, and boy, I'll tell you, if anybody's never done that, you have no idea how big Texas is till you try to drive across it. It's a long, long, long day of driving if you even make it from one end to the other. And you don't think of places like, you know, even the big cities, you don't think of Houston or Dallas necessarily as having a big jazz scene, especially back in the old days, but maybe it did. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. Houston did have a lively jazz scene. There was a big band there that was terrific, and people like Illinois Jacquette and another tenor that I suddenly forget were both out of Houston and had been in that band. That was in early 30s, mid-30s. And then, of course, Illinois Jacquette ended up in the Hampton band, Lionel Hampton. So, yeah, some of the big cities did have bands and an active scene. But there were, and even a place like Laredo on the border with Mexico, there was a band there, and there were people that even in more recent times have come from there, but not really the kind of scene that they had in New Orleans, for sure.
But as you point out, enough that this very talented group of people, they got, I guess, whatever clues they got, and it was enough for them.
Yeah,
to get started and get on the road to mastery. For instance, it amazes me. So Jack Teagarden was playing jazz and didn't even know that it had a name?
Right, exactly. I mean, that was 1920, 21, right in there. I mean, that's even before Armstrong and Oliver recorded, you know. So, yeah, it's just it's mind-blowing, really.
Let's talk a little bit about Jack Teagarden as a point of departure. So you say that, you know, he was somebody from Texas City, come from a big city, a small place?
No, a very small town, Vernon. And still, you know, a small town. There's not much going on there. But in his case, and this is interesting for a lot of Texas musicians like Bud Johnson or Eddie Durham, these musicians came from families that were musicians. Jack Teagarden and all of his siblings were musicians, and his brother Charlie was a fabulous trumpet player, And Gunther Schuller said he's never heard a solo by him that wasn't great. So
wow.
A lot of times it was a family tradition out of which these musicians developed. And at first they probably were not playing jazz. For instance, Eddie Durham was playing for a ranch band. No telling what kind of music they were playing. And also he played for circuses, you know, so it probably wasn't jazz, but he got very interested in studying harmony and took a course by correspondence. I mean, that's to me is so wonderful. Here he is down in Texas, and he's taking a theory course by correspondence from New York. I guess it's New York.
Yeah.
And then he became a great arranger for Basie and Lunsford and other bands. I mean, just, you know. So it is, to me, fascinating how these musicians, as you say, they got enough to be able to move on and then become really masters of their art.
Well, one of the big centers of jazz, of course, was Kansas City. And
oh, yeah, that was so important to Texans.
Tell us a little bit about that, because we're all familiar with Kansas City being a really important place and a driving force in the creation of jazz, but wasn't Kansas City fed to a large degree by people from Texas, and I'm going to say Oklahoma too?
Exactly, yeah, Oklahoma and Texas musicians probably predominated, and every band had multiple musicians from Texas and Oklahoma. Don Cherry, of course, later, but these are earlier musicians like Jay McShann. And for Oklahoma, there's just a slew of them, really, just a bunch of them.
And this is something that New Yorkers, or, you know, because when we, you know, we have our mailing list, our subscribers, and I can see where people subscribe from. And understandably, we have a lot of subscribers from New York City, a lot of subscribers from Chicago, a lot of subscribers from LA. Those are big cities. And just might be a surprise to know that really, if you're going to look at one of the creative forces in jazz from the beginning to the present, you really got to look at Texas. And I'm throwing in Oklahoma too.
They go together in a way.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the map, it looks like someone carved Oklahoma out of was Texas originally.
Right.
There's a river there, and yeah, I just looked up where Jack Teagarden's from in Vernon, and wow, yeah, I mean, that town's way out there. It looks like
it's not close to any centers that, you know, you would think of as jazz.
I mean, it looks to me like it's over 200 miles from Dallas.
Yeah, yeah.
So, that's pretty far out there. So all those formative bands like Benny Moten and the Blue Devils,
right,
and Count Basie, and you, of course, Jay McShann, these were staffed by a lot of guys from Texas and Oklahoma.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it was really important for so many Texans that were able to perform in Kansas City all hours, you know. They really developed their art, and some of them went to New York or Chicago and did well there and, you know, got a name. But in so many ways, most of the musicians were fairly unknown, you know. I mean, they just were in the bands, and you didn't realize how important they were. For instance, one of my favorites, one of the greatest recordings that Lester Young ever made was for a small group with Basie, and the trumpet player was supposed to be Hot Lips Page from Dallas, but I think he had split his lip or something. And so they brought in this other trumpet player from Texas, just basically totally unknown. And he just did a fabulous job. His solos are, you know, right up there with Lester Young's, and yet, I mean, he's just not a household name at all. So many musicians who were on a lower level in terms of name recognition, you know, contributed brilliantly to so many of the best recordings in jazz history.
Well, you know, it's show business, and in all businesses, there's sort of a promotional hierarchy. Some people are very good at self-promotion, or the label decides that, gee, we need a star, so we're going to make a star, and they'll put a lot of energy behind a given individual. And that may or may not be equivalent to that person's value as a musician, you know? Or let's put it another way. There are musicians that are of incredible merit who never became stars because they were not either, you know, maybe they didn't travel. You know, part of being a star is you have to be willing to resettle. You know, I often think of the great Von Freeman, the great tenor man out of Chicago, and he just chose to stay home. You know?
That happened with a number of Texans.
Okay.
A piano player and Pete, what was his name, Kelly? No, but a piano player who played with Jack Teagarden in the early 20s, and he just never left Houston. All his friends tried to get him to go elsewhere, but he never left, so, you know, he just was not known.
Yeah, so if you're not up for or willing to leave your home and resettle in New York or Chicago, if you're not willing to be on the road all year, because that's what it takes to develop a name, that's what it takes to sell records, and you know, the record company's really not going to back anybody who's not willing to tour all the time. And that's something we as fans may not realize, how just what a physical toll the profession of being a high-profile jazz person takes.
Relatedly, one of the things that I discovered in writing the Texan Jazz book was that so many Texans came back to Texas, and they always wanted to come back. And Gene Ramey, for instance, you know, who was with Jay McShann and practiced with Charlie Parker, he came back and continued to play here in Austin, where he was born. And Bud Johnson the same way. They wanted to come back, you know. They missed their world here. So that you can see why people were resistant to leave in some ways. Some of them were, and others always wanted to come back.
And the musical culture of Texas, even though, you know, it didn't have, you know, the infrastructure of jazz clubs that New York City had or Chicago had, I do remember talking with Ornette about what life was like growing up in Fort Worth. He was born in 1930, and he said you would walk down the street and there would be some kind of live music going on everywhere. Guys would be singing, guys would be playing the comb with wax paper. I don't know what that is, but
he
talked about, you know,
kind of like a kazoo.
So they didn't provide, you know, if they didn't have an, if, by the way, I'm following a track, I'll send you an email about it, about a guy that's finding great connections between what's called barbershop quartet music and the origins of jazz, especially in New Orleans. And he makes the point that, and Louis Armstrong never hid this, it was always in his biography, that he started out with a quartet, a vocal quartet.
That's right, yeah.
So even though these places may not have been materially as sophisticated, let's say, as New York, people might not have had instruments, as easy access to instruments, that doesn't mean they weren't playing a lot of music and weren't really dedicated.
Right. And Ornette Coleman is a great example of that, because he picked up so many different styles that are in the state and incorporated them in his harmonic music. Yeah, that was one of the things that I loved about reading and listening to Ornette. You could hear all these influences from Spanish American music to country and western. I mean, it's all there in Ornette.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point. And of course, the blues too.
Oh, absolutely. The Texans were deeply, you know, affected by blues, and even Teagarden is considered perhaps the best white blues singer in jazz.
So you had that really strong blues component running through everything. But then, as you point out, there were other kinds of music that Ornette and all the other musicians heard. There is strong Mexican-American music and music forms.
Right.
And then, of course, the country western stuff. I'm sure somebody else has pointed that out about Ornette. People tend to point out the avant-garde quality of what he does, his work. And of course, that's there. But you're right. When you listen to what he actually plays, you hear all these strains of various music from all kinds of different cultures.
Yeah.
You know, I'm talking from the viewpoint of an Easterner, you know, a Northerner. I think we underestimate how culturally diverse Texas is. You know,
and
sometimes
jazz
we think,
is,
you know,
really, yeah.
I mean, we you know, everybody's got stereotypes, and so we probably think, well, you know, everybody in Texas is wearing a cowboy hat and a huge
right.
belt buckle, and you know,
yeah.
and it's a lot more rich and complex than that.
Yeah, that's evident in what's been called Western swing, which had so much influence from the country western sort of side, and people think. They associate Texas more with that kind of music, but that is another element that is involved in jazz, especially as practiced by Texans.
And Texas swing itself has a lot of jazz elements in it, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's right.
So there must have been even though, you know, the music was diffused throughout the whole state, it wasn't concentrated in Dallas, for example, or in Houston, there must have been a lot of opportunities and occasions where live music was featured in the culture,
yeah.
in the everyday culture of Texas. Can you talk a little bit about how that worked out?
Well, in the case of Austin, which is not thought of as a jazz city, although there have been a few outstanding musicians like Gene Ramey, who are here from here, one of the things that I discovered in my research was that, again, in the 20s, there were bands here that primarily played for events at the university because the university was sort of the attraction from throughout the state. Young people came here, and of course they wanted entertainment when they weren't studying or instead of studying.
Uh-huh.
And so there were a number of really fine bands. One that recorded in 1923, and it traveled to California, terrific band, recording, you know, the same year as Oliver and Armstrong, and they're just amazing things that they're doing there. And that band basically was made up of students from the university. And there were other bands to follow. Trumpet player that one of the British jazz critics discovered that people thought he was Bix Beiderbecke. In my Jazz Mavericks book, I talk all about this. They thought it was Bix Beiderbecke, but it was a guy from Austin. I mean, he was a student here, and he and his brother and I think another family member had their own little band even before. Well, let's see. Well, it was in the 20s for sure, and he later recorded in 1930, I think it was. And that's when, and he took a solo that this jazz critic, British critic, thought was Bix Beiderbecke because it was so, and it sounds like Bix Beiderbecke. So, you know, you just don't know how it is that these people, this guy was from Cameron, which is a tiny little town, sort of northeast of Austin, 50, 60 miles from here. And just amazing, I mean, and he never, I heard some other recordings of him, but he never recorded another solo that was quite as astounding, you know. So it's almost like, well, that's a problem for a lot of those early people was they were not close to recording centers. They didn't have a chance to be recorded, so we don't know how much more great work they did. But in this case, at least one fabulous solo.
Good point. You know, for example, even Louis Armstrong, I believe, did not get recorded till he made it to Chicago.
No, not till 23, yeah.
Yeah, because there were no, the idea of recording African-American musicians in New Orleans didn't happen.
Right.
You know, wasn't on the agenda in those days. So there's a case where here's a guy, he was in a big city. He had a big talent, he had a big reputation. And he still had to travel 1,000 miles or more, 2,000 miles or whatever it is from New Orleans to Chicago, just to record. So if somebody's out in the countryside of Texas, and by the way, you know, 60 miles, we should all remember in the 1920s, 60 miles was a long. It's not like today
right.
where you just jump
That's
in your
right.
car and you're there on the interstate. It's probably a day's trip.
Right.
So at the time that jazz was breaking out and starting to become a thing in the world, it was already alive and well and thriving in Texas. In other words, it's not that it started in New Orleans, and then somehow the people in Texas heard the radio or heard records. They had their own thing going on. They had
to
have.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. Of course, radio was a big influence on some of them, but not all. As I was mentioning, that trumpet player who was with Woody Herman, they didn't even have a radio. Some were lucky enough to hear great bands on the radio, but others had no idea.
Yeah, not everybody could afford a radio, and especially in those days, they were still relatively new. It was still a relatively new consumer invention. Hey, so we basically have this and this mystery that even you, who's written two books on this, really are not able to solve, which is how so many amazing musicians, because usually we think of musicians coming out of a community of jazz, you know?
Right.
There's just a lot of jazz going on, and some people are attracted to it, and people, you know, get playing opportunities, and bit by bit they get better. But it sounds like there were a lot of self-taught people. You mentioned the fellow that got his theory training from correspondence course via the mail.
Right.
You know, Jack Teagarden growing up in, really, I'll tell you guys, look it up. Look up Vernon, Texas on the map. It is not near anything. So it's a new vision of jazz. It's a new view on jazz. And you could probably take this same theme and apply it to a lot of other states.
Right.
You know, all the great musicians that came out of southern Indiana, you know, who would expect that?
Yeah, but I guess one of the my son and I went to Germany about a year and a half ago to attend a conference in Darmstadt. And let's see, was it Darmstadt? I can't remember. We were in Darmstadt. And one of the papers that was delivered was a woman from South Carolina. And I taught for a year in South Carolina. And it never dawned on me that South Carolina would have produced, you know, great jazz musicians. Of course, that's where Dizzy Gillespie was from.
Sure.
And I hadn't thought about that, you know. I knew that he was from there, but somehow it just didn't hit me. And this woman gave a great paper on, as you say, community that produced lots of jazz musicians and had a great band. I can't remember the name of the band, but I had heard of it. And I think it was recorded. But
yep.
To your point, you know, what might seem the most unlikely states, Wisconsin, for instance, have a piece in there on Wisconsin musicians. And, I mean, that's not a state that we associate with jazz, and yet there were important people from there. It's just endless.
Mm. Hey, well, I want to talk a little bit about your books. And, guys, these are fantastic books. If you're interested in the history of jazz and you want to expand your horizons and you want your mind blown, I would start with Texan Jazz. And I'm just going to talk a little bit about how it's put together. There's the first part talks about what was going on in East Texas, ragtime and country blues, classic blues and boogie-woogie. And then part two is all about the flow of Texans and Oklahomans to the great jazz center of Kansas City. And you talk about Benny Moten and the Blue Devils. The Blue Devils, such an important group, very underrated for their influence on the development of jazz. Count Basie, of course. Then you talk about all the Texans that made their way to the Big Apple.
Right.
And including a lot of beboppers. And then the Texans that went in the other direction, that went to another great, somewhat underrated music jazz center, which is Los Angeles, you know, where so much great music came out of Los Angeles. Ornette, you mentioned, is it, you know, Texan that went to Los Angeles first. Charles Mingus is from...
Before him, Jimmy Giuffre.
Okay.
One of the people that I first discovered in high school was a Texan. At the time, it didn't hit me as important, but he sort of was my first awareness. He and Jack Teagarden were the earliest recognition on my part of Texas jazz musicians.
Great. So that last part of Texan Jazz talks about the Texans in Los Angeles and the big impact they had there. One thing, let's talk about this too, which people may not realize, is when you think of bebop, you pretty much are thinking of, now, it's interesting, Charlie Parker's from Kansas City, which is, you know, it's in the cultural sphere of Texas, Oklahoma. And of course, you know, you mentioned that Dizzy was originally from South Carolina, but they all met in New York. And but bebop is thought of as a play, as a New York invention. But you point out that a lot of Texans were involved in that innovation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, one of the very first official bebop recordings involved Bud Johnson, tenor saxophone player from Dallas. He was sort of the one of the organizers. And so Texans were right there, you know, at the beginning. Even somebody like Charlie Christian, who was sort of, in fact, I think there was a title of a tune, Swing to Bop or something like that. And I believe he recorded a piece like that. And so he was sort of a transitional figure in between, and he was from Texas. And then Hot Lips Page was on the scene. He didn't really, again, it's more like swing and then moving into bop.
Well, let's take a look at an urban area in Texas, so that produced a lot of musicians, and that would be Fort Worth.
Dallas.
Dallas and Fort Worth. Let's look at the amazing high school. I am Terrell. Is that how you pronounce the last name?
I'm not sure myself, but it could be Tyrell.
Okay.
But I don't
Tyrell.
Know. Tyrell? Yeah.
Okay.
In Fort Worth.
And a lot of musicians came out of that school.
Absolutely.
Ornette.
Yeah.
For example,
Dewey Redman,
Charles Moffett. Now,
right.
Ornette, and I'm related to this part of the story, is Ornette talks about. I heard him talk about this player, and he mentioned this, by the way. I want to tell listeners this. He would often talk about all the great musicians that were never recorded or never known. I mean, he was acutely aware of that. And a lot of them were from Texas, where he grew up. Because remember, he didn't get out of Texas until his 20s, later 20s. So that was his musical environment. And he talked about a tenor player named Red Connors.
Right, he's legendary.
And yet, I don't know that people. And I mean, Ornette went so far, and you quote him as saying this, that he was up right up there with Lester Young, in terms of quality and in terms of innovation.
Yeah, but no recordings.
And no recordings. And, you know, we really only are ever seeing the tip of the iceberg. You know, we're only seeing the recordings that are still in existence, which is a fraction of the recordings that were made. And then we're not seeing all the great musicians that were never recorded. Of course, here's the thing, we hear echoes of their music in the music of living musicians. So that's how we get a feeling, right? Now, I want to we've talked about Texan jazz, and I really, guys, everybody, I encourage this. It's going to amplify your understanding of this art form. You wrote a second book called Jazz Mavericks of the Lone Star State, and in this book you take certain topics and really put the magnifying glass to them. You know, for instance, there's chapters on bebop. There's a chapter on Ornette in L.A. You have a chapter on Western swing. So this is another great book to follow if you're finding this topic interesting. Now, what I want to talk about now and focus our attention on is this poem novel. Well, not really a novel. It's a biography, but a biography length poem about the great Kenny Durham. Tell us a little about Kenny Durham.
Well, he was born in the smallest of small places in Texas called Post Oak. And I tried to find that town, and my wife and I drove and drove, and we went to Fairfield, which is the town closest to Post Oak, but we could never find it. We drove out following some directions and just never did find it. And that's how small it was. I mean, not even sure that it was even a town. But he grew up in Fairfield. And then, I guess when he was 10 or 12, he came to Austin. And that's when he picked up the trumpet. And he talked about a trumpet player here in town that was sort of like Red Connors, that he just thought was terrific. And he, again, never recorded. But Kenny Dorham played here in Austin, and then he went to college at Wiley College in East Texas. And there were a lot of Texas jazz musicians that ended up in the Basie band, for instance. There were three. There was a trombone player, and Wild Bill Davis, an arranger, was there, and Kenny Dorham. And Eddie Preston, that I mentioned before, was there. And Eddie Preston went to Los Angeles, and that's where he got in with Mingus and other people there. Oh, and then there was also a drummer who recorded with Charlie Parker at that school. So Wiley College was an incredible source for jazz musicians here in Texas. And again, you know, just a little known school. It's all black college because at the time, you know, they couldn't go to the university here or anywhere else in white schools. So really an amazing story, Kenny Dorham, and ended up, you know, recording with Parker for almost 2 years after Miles Davis left. So I had thought about writing something on Kenny Dorham, and then it struck me that, you know, why not a biography, but write it in verse, which is my big interest, along with jazz, my two loves, my third, of course, my wife. Incidentally, my wife is from Chile, and that's another interest of mine, Chilean poetry. I have a new book coming out all in Spanish from a press at North Carolina State University. I'm waiting any day for it to arrive. Well, that's beside the point anyway. But so I just jumped into that thing and just thoroughly enjoyed doing it. It's sort of crazy, and it may be unreadable, but I love doing it.
Well, you know what I'm getting from it is it looks like you went record by record.
Yeah.
You discuss in poetic form every recording that Kenny Dorham made. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, I did miss one particularly great recording session in Paris. But I do have something in there about the group that he recorded with, because they were in a film, in a French film together. So I do mention it, but I missed that recording. I have it now, but it's too late.
Okay. I hope you're okay with this. I'm just going to read something, someone at random from this, just to give people a flavor.
Great.
Okay.
Yeah.
But now his wings spread as never before, and if blind to tongue attacking of JR will end so soon, yet shows has begun to fulfill his early signs as soothsayer, reading soaring bird in an upper region unexplored by even the epic poets as he works its swingingly happy theme with Elan, and not letting up until his cadenza, he says bye-bye, each sideman strong in his way, bold soloing by Sam on K's Blue Elegante, and by Dick comping till tenorist enters all aglow to carry the torch past to K, holds it high, his DX as good as it gets, as fast and fluid, he and JR both on a veritable changes, tear unriddlingly, I got rhythm, as if any druid gushing blood of augury from bull or hare, chord progressions in a mysterious tongue of brass and reed, with the fingers and thumbs hammering keys, skins or strings, as moon-driven as tides percussing at night or noon. Who's J.R. in this passage?
J.R. Monterose.
Ah, okay.
A white tenor player who recorded with Mingus, the Pithecanthus erectus. Is that the name of it? Pithecanthus?
Yes.
Yeah. He's
like
on
that.
There with Jackie McLean.
Ah.
They're the two saxes on that great recording.
So I'll tell you, this is I want to say that I don't think any artist in any realm, whether it's jazz or music at large or any art form, has ever gotten such a tribute as this poem. I think this is amazing. You guys, if somebody, if you like poetry, or you and you love jazz, or if you just want to see jazz described in very, I don't know the right word. I'm going to say unique, but that's a cheap word. But if you want to experience jazz in words in a very unique way, the book is called KD for Kenny Durham, A Jazz Biography by Dave Oliphant. And I'm loving it. I'm really, it's cool. It's like the reading the Iliad, you know, or the Odyssey. Maybe the Odyssey's a better example. You know, you follow Kenny Durham as he goes through all his changes and all the different people he played with and all the recordings he was on. And you know, it's hard to describe music. You know, they're words and music are really different realms. So we have all these reviewers writing reviews and, you know, so on. And it's useful and interesting and helpful. But it's great when a poet does this. Hey, speaking of writing and jazz, you taught a course at the University of Texas on jazz literature?
Right, yeah.
That must have been you get into it a little bit in one of your books, I think. You reference.
Right, in the Jazz Mavericks book, I talk about it, yeah.
You have a whole chapter, yeah. It's called, oh, I don't know what it is, but it's in there somewhere.
It's Jazz in Literature, I think it's called.
Oh, Jazz in Literature. Sure enough. Yeah. So one of the things that I got from that chapter is, wow, there's a lot more jazz literature and a lot of high quality jazz literature that I just wasn't aware of. And so given that, you know, we all can't go over to take your course, we can get a flavor of what you taught in that course, I'm going to guess, from this particular chapter.
Right. One of the things that was particularly exciting to me when I was working on that piece was that I happened to catch a program on PBS television that's called History Detectives. Have you ever caught that?
No, that's new to me.
Oh, it's a great series. I don't think they're doing it anymore now, but they're still doing, they're replaying, you know, episodes from it. And in this one particular one, a man contacted them and said that he had a saxophone that someone told him had belonged to Charlie Parker. And that Parker had pawned it, you know, somewhere, I think it was in Washington State, and when he was on the East Coast at some point, I mean on the West Coast, and I don't know how he got up to Washington, but anyway, the point is that so the history detectives were going to find out if it really was a horn that was played by Parker. And so they went to the pawn shop. They found the ticket from when he pawned it. It was in the case. And they went and talked to the people there. And then they went and talked to a specialist in saxophones. And the guy told them, yes. They said, this looks like such a sorry instrument. And the guy said, look, if you're as great as Charlie Parker, he is singing through this thing. It's going to sound great. It doesn't matter what kind of horn he had. It could be all taped together. And said, the horn is just going to amplify his singing. And I just love that. So I mentioned that in that particular piece because I discuss a short story written by a writer in Dallas, a short story and novelist. And he had a character that did the same thing. And so I connected the two in the article, how this piece of literature was related to something actual in jazz. So that was quite a discovery for me.
A neat story.
I want to say that everything you said about my KD book, music to my ears.
Well, it's how I feel. And somewhere on our website, I don't know where, but if people search, they'll probably be able to find it. There's a story from Phil Woods about his meeting with Charlie Parker when Phil Woods was a young man, And it's exactly what you just said about the horn. Phil Woods had this really messed up horn, and he was very depressed about it, and he felt he couldn't get any music out of it. And somehow he ran into Charlie Parker, and Charlie Parker needed a horn. And so he took Phil's. Phil sat there that night and heard the most heavenly music coming out of that beaten up, raggedy
horn. Oh, that's
horn.
Great. That's great. I wish I would have known that.
Yeah. And it was the great lesson for Phil that it's nice to have a good instrument. It's not about the instrument. It's about the singing behind it.
Yeah.
So this has been a thrilling call for me, knowing that these books existed, now I have them in my hands, which is even more thrilling, and I'm able to start reading them. The first is I'm going to call it the Bible because it's big. It's Texan Jazz by Dave Oliphant, and that's OLIPHANT. The next book, which is a follow-up to it and fills in some of the gaps, because as Dave mentioned, there's no end to this story. Every time he thinks he's come to the end, he finds some new twist and turn that he wasn't aware of. So he's covering some of that in Jazz Mavericks of the Lone Star State. A lot of great things in there, especially that chapter, Jazz and Literature, if you're interested in that subject. This is a great, great source for that. And then if you want to experience something really beautiful and unique, KD, A Jazz Biography. It's in poetic form. I don't know much about poetry. It's everything's four lines. Is that a stanza? Do you call that a stanza?
It's a stanza of quatrains.
Okay. Yeah. The whole thing's written in quatrains, and I love it. I'm really glad it exists. And so we're going to put links to all these books at the bottom of the page. And if you love jazz, I really strongly encourage that you get one more or all. If you're from Texas, you got to get one. If you have a friend from Texas, this would be a great gift for them. It really opened their eyes to the cultural richness of their state, which I bet not even the most Texans are even vaguely aware of.
Right.
Well, Dave, thank you so much for the time. It was a pleasure to meet you. Thanks for your beautiful work in helping illuminate this art that we all love.
Well, thank you for having me. It was great.
We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please share it. That's how we grow. And remember to subscribe to jazzonthetube.com, the internet's largest collection of free, streamable, classic jazz videos. Thank you.